Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Ursula K. Le Guin. As you can read on her website, ursulakleguin.com, she was a celebrated author whose body of work includes 23 novels, 12 volumes of short stories, 11 volumes of poetry, 13 children's books, 5 essay collections, and 4 works of translation. The breadth and imagination of her work earned her 6 Nebula Awards, 7 Hugo Awards, and the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association's Grand Master Award, along with the Penn Malamud and many other awards. In 2014, she was awarded the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters, and in 2016 joined the shortlist of authors to be published in their lifetimes by the Library of America. For this episode, we are honored to speak with multi-award-winning science fiction and comics author Charlie Jane Anders. And Theo Downs Le Guin, Ursula's son and the trustee of the Ursula K. Le Guin Literary Trust. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Charlie Jane and Theo are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place June 28, 2023, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Charlie Jane and Theo, for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm really excited to talk about Ursula K. Le Guin with you both and get into her legacy and what she means to you. Before we get into that, maybe if you could, for our listeners, give us a little bit about yourselves and how you first encountered Ursula K. Le Guin's work and what that's meant to you. Charlie Jane, if you'd like to start.
Yeah, hi. My name is Charlie Jane Anders. I'm a science fiction writer. Most recently, I published a young adult trilogy, like a space opera trilogy. The first book is Victory is Greater Than Death. I've also been writing the New Mutants Lethal Legion comic for Marvel Comics. And I'm currently the science fiction fantasy book review columnist for the Washington Post. And I'm also working on I'm finishing an adult novel called The Prodigal Mother about a young woman who teaches her mother how to do magic, which is, you know, like a lot of my adult works, heavily influenced by Le Guin. I first really encountered Le Guin in my early 20s. I read, you know, the Earthsea trilogy, like the first Earthsea. Actually, I think I read all of the Earthsea books in one go, like the original trilogy and then the later sequels all in one go. And, you know, I remember I was traveling around the country with sort of a punk rock spoken word tour where we were kind of sleeping on floors and like performing in tiny cafes and like, you know, little anarchist spaces and wherever they would let us perform. And, living and breathing and sleeping with anarchists most of the time. And I was reading The Dispossessed in the car on that trip, and it just hit me so hard. Like it's discussion of anarchism, it's discussion of, you know, what it means to have a collective life and to try to live for your community. And, you know, the upsides and downsides of that, the honesty with which Le Guin discusses those, you know, those two worlds, Urus and Anaris, or those the world and the moon, I guess. And I just remember it feeling like, I mean, that novel would have felt powerful at any moment, but while I was in somebody's beat up car driving from one anarchist space to the next, it really hit me hard. And I was like, yeah, this is capturing something really essential about what I'm living through right now. And it felt like it spoke to me directly. And so that was when I think that's when I really fell in love with Le Guin's writing. And I've pretty much devoured almost everything she wrote.
I love that. I love how a book can hit you right at the right time, you know, and right when you need it. Yeah. And Theo, how about yourself? Your relationship with Le Guin is a little bit unique for this conversation, at least.
Yes, I encountered her at a very young age. Yeah, I'm the youngest of Ursula and Charles's 3 children, and I'm also her literary executor. So we worked together for a long time while she was alive. And, you know, in retrospect, I think she was getting me ready for a long time for the role that I am now in. But it was a very gradual process over decades, literally. And my first encounter with her work, so I was born in 1964, you know, her career really took off in the late 60s and into the mid-70s when she had a kind of Cambrian explosion of novels that were met with acclaim. And so I was a very young child when, she was writing long before I was born, but I was a young child when she was doing a lot of that writing of the books for which she is best known. She had a very light touch in how she exposed her work to her kids. So she always held back author's copies of all her books for us, but she did not compel us to read them. She did not talk about her work while she was writing it. And so I kind of had to make my way to her work on my own, and it took a long time. I am often asked if I've read everything she's written. And I reckon at this point I've read most of it, but I am by no means a completist. There are many people who have read her work more than I have, because, you know, there's a period in your youth when you don't want your parents' voice in your head in any form, or not so much. So there was a period when I did not really seek out her work. If something new came out, I might read it. But I didn't necessarily seek it out. And now, of course, I can't get enough of it. I want that voice in my head all the time.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned a little bit about her process just there. I'm curious how it was like growing up, in the house with a writer such as Le Guin, and also how, you know, I think we hear a lot of writers and we'll always see them in the public sphere. But curious is to know how she balanced, the writing life and also, the parenting life.
She wrote and spoke about that quite a bit, because especially as into the 90s and later when people actually began to think about that and who does the work in the household and how they balance that with their other work, that became a much more common question than it was in the 60s and 70s in interviews and in discussions with readers and fans. And it did change over time. I will say my father was a terrific sharer of the parenting and household chore load. So Ursula was very lucky in her choice of spouse as a writer. And she always gave him first credit for creating the space for her to do what she needed to do. But he also taught full-time as a university professor for the entirety of his career. So by definition, he was out of the house quite a bit. When we were young children, she wrote often after we went to sleep, which was not her preference. She was much more of a morning person than a night person, but she did it when she could do it. Once we went to school, things got a little easier, although I'm several years behind my sisters, so I probably caused some problems because, I hung around for a while before I went to school. But that was a real turning point when she had that morning time returned to her and she could write as soon as we went to school, which was her preferred time. And I believe that she kind of used the morning for writing and then the afternoon for getting ready for the kids to return and cooking and shopping and so forth.
Yeah, that makes sense. I myself am also much better in the morning. I get a little too tired at night. So yeah, I understand that. So as she was writing, I've been reading a lot about her work, and I got this great book one of my coworkers has on her desk, so it was great to borrow.
There it is. Yeah.
So yeah, there's Conversations on Writing with Ursula K. Le Guin and David Naiman. It's been fascinating to read. One thing that caught my interest was all of the many influences she cites throughout those conversations. And I'm curious if you know of any, Theo growing up, like what was on her bookshelves, what was on her nightstand. And that doesn't need to be just American writers, because her influences seem worldwide, from Asian religions anyone who was writing good stuff, basically. So I'm curious if either of you know of any of her literary predecessors that were especially important to her growth as a writer.
Well, she was asked that question, fairly often. And she frequently cited Kipling, Dickens, Virginia Woolf, Tolkien, of course. She talked about coming to Virginia Woolf relatively late as a reader. I think she said something to the effect that, you know, she needed to learn to read Virginia Woolf, but she always said, you know, if you're thinking about your influences and who to be inspired by, aim for the top. And so those were among her top, although she was a very widely read, as you would expect. And she was a fast reader, which I envy. So she read a lot. She was also not burdened by the need to finish a book if she didn't care for it. And so that, you know, that's a very, very scratching the surface of her influences.
Yeah, for my part, I'm just going to say that I know that she was heavily influenced by a lot of her contemporaries, and that she was part of a whole group of women and people of color who came, and queer people who came to writing speculative fiction in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I know from reading about her development of her writing that people like Joanna Russ were her contemporaries and her peers, but also sometimes held her feet to the fire a little bit. Like, I know that Joanna Russ sometimes was critical of Le Guin's writing, and that Le Guin actually took that seriously and took that on board. And that, you know, I think that having these contemporaries made her better. I think that writers like Samuel Delany and Eleanor Arneson and Kate Wilhelm, and just, you know, and there's a whole bunch of amazing women authors of that generation, some of whom we don't really remember anymore, but who were very important at the time and remain, I think, really important. And it's, you know, I feel like she was part of a community, and that was part of, and Thomas Dish also is another person I think of. And I think it's important to recognize that.
I think it's interesting that in interviews, although she was certainly happy to talk about that community that she was part of, she typically would cite more, you know, kind of canonical writers from her childhood than she would cite those peer writers. I don't really know the reason for that. Perhaps it's just that it's more complicated to talk about your peers. And what certainly from my perspective, she was very generous in acknowledging the influence of those peers and the discussions that were ongoing between them, including the feet held to the fire discussions, which, you know, were really challenging, but also to which she responded in very profound ways by changing what she wrote about and how she wrote, and in some cases by revising what she'd already written in an experimental way.
Yeah, well said. And the mention of the canon, right, is the, I've read many pieces by her, or, you know, speeches given as well about the, you know, who gets to decide who's in the canon, and that it's almost always white men who have historically been deciding, white straight men, I should say, specifically. And yeah, I'm curious about her early writing career. It was hard to get published at first, from what I understand. I'm not gonna get the quote exactly, but paraphrase that she realized that they're decided to do it her way no matter what, which I found inspiring. And Theo, maybe could you give a little bit of a, for our listeners, a little bit of a history on her writing career and you know, the trials she had to go through to get off the ground in publishing?
Sure. I'm going to give you one more answer to the previous question that you can choose to drop in or not.
And oh, no, even better.
But a big influence on her was poetry, because she wrote poetry before she wrote prose, and she wrote poetry throughout her life. And that is, you know, a relatively unacknowledged part of her writing career for many readers and critics. And she was in a poetry group for decades here in Oregon. And that group was profoundly influential on her writing. David Naiman did a podcast last year with Molly Gloss as a guest. Molly was in that writing group with Ursula. And Molly has some wonderful comments on what it was like to be in the poetry group with Ursula. But I think that, you know, just that, because most people think of her as a prose writer first and foremost, or only know her prose work, it's really easy to underestimate the influence that reading poetry had and working with other poets had on her writing. To your second question, you know, as I mentioned, her career kind of took off in the late 60s with the publication of A Wizard of Earthsea. That was not the first work that was published, but it was the first novel length work. She received many, many rejection letters before that. She started writing when she was about 8 years old, and she started submitting not too long after that. And I think there was a hiatus in the submission process as she grew up, but resumed writing and submitting in her 20s. So she went through the same long and I'm sure very painful process that most writers do before she achieved any kind of success. And she was happy to talk about that and to share the rejection letters, some of which are quite funny. And I aspire someday to publish some of those, maybe on social media or something kind of casual, because many of the letters are really very specific and helpful and kind. And some of them are exactly what you would expect. Those traditions carry on today with editors and publishers, I believe. But everyone wants to be accepted quickly, right? And for it to all happen quickly, that's always nice. But I never heard her speak with too much rancor about that period. It maybe was longer than she wanted. I'm sure there was a lot of frustration along the way. But when things started to happen, they happened well. And as you said, Nate, she was kind of able to do it her way, which is the most any writer can hope for, I believe, to do it your way and to finally be recognized, even if it takes a while.
Yeah. And not to, you know, tailor make the story or whatever to be sellable, you know, but to let the story unfold as it was meant to be told, which I really respect about her and her writing. Charlie Dean, did you find a similar parallel in your own career as you started out writing?
I mean, yeah, I think that I definitely had, it took me a very long time to break in as an author. And I think that is a common pattern. There certainly are writers who, you know, write something in college and just like lightning strikes and they get a book deal when they're 21 and, you know, then they're like a New York Times bestseller and, you know, then their career explodes in their early 20s. That certainly happens. But I think for a lot of us, for a lot of writers, you just keep kind of scratching at the door and trying to improve your craft and trying to find, you know, the thing that's going to like trying to find your voice as a writer, but also just trying to find ways of telling a story that are going to actually resonate with people and that are going to achieve your goals. And that took me a long time. There were things that I had to kind of figure out and things I had to get past. I also do think that as a trans woman back in the 2000s, there were probably some barriers for me breaking into publishing that weren't there for other people. And that's part of why it took a long time, I think, is just because there were, you know, I was very aware that if you were openly trans, people expected you to write one thing in particular and they weren't sure if they wanted that one thing, but if they wanted anything for you, it was going to be that one thing. And so I really, it took me a long time to be able to write the stories I wanted to write the way I wanted to write them, for sure.
You know, publishing was a very different industry in the 1960s than it is now. And I think many of the changes are positive ones, but I do wonder sometimes whether things have become easier or more difficult for writers who are not writing exactly the way the industry wants them to. And I think it's probably a bit of both, but you know, it certainly was not easy being a housewife, as my mother described herself at that time, and you know, in her late 30s or early 40s, trying to break into publishing with fantasy novels. And so now I think that there's an established market for fantasy. There's much more comfort amongst corporate publishers with how to handle genre. But I still think there are difficulties barriers and blind spots abound.
Agreed. Yeah, which is unfortunate. And Charlie Jane, you mentioned two things that caught my attention, and one was, you know, as a trans woman, like you said, publishers want that one thing, right? That one story. And right before this, I was still, you know, getting through that Conversations on Writing book, and Le Guin was talking about, you know, as far as who gets to be in the canon, right? Like women writers are often the exception to, rather than just being on the same level as their male peers there, you know, instead of just a great American novelist, to use that phrase, they're the, you know, a great woman American novelist, you know, which is a shame. It's writing at the end of the day is writing. But then the other thing you said, which was also a quote that I really loved from that same book, is, you know, she says, "You can't find your own voice if you aren't listening for it," which I love that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that, you know, that, like many writing, you know, writing books or writing advice books, it's always applicable to life too. So that really, yeah, at a time where I'm trying to, you know, find myself, that was a really good reminder. I'm curious, as you, you know, both are writers in your own ways. What did you, I guess, learn from Ursula's writing, or her approach to writing, even that you've incorporated into your own, as far as, you know, like, you know, listening for that voice, and she always talks in many of these interviews, talks about the listening for the rhythm that's underneath it all, and going deep enough into that to hear it, and then just kind of being a conduit for that sound, and letting the words flow. So I'm curious if you picked up anything from her in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like her prose is so beautiful, and the way that she conjures a sense of place and a mood is really just powerful and amazing. And I definitely have found myself rereading passages of her work just to see, kind of try to like piece together, how did she do this? I feel like there's so many layers in her work. There's so much, so many layers of, you know, like, backing up slightly, when people talk about Le Guin, they often talk about her world building. Like, I feel like her world building is the thing that's kind of like, it's the most obvious or the most kind of apparent virtue of her work that people always gravitate towards, because she was a master world builder. Like, she creates societies and worlds and settings and milieu that are so rich and so complicated. And she's so good at conjuring a sense of place, which is one of the hardest things for a writer to do, especially about places that are not real, especially about places that you've dreamed up. You know, it's one thing, like I found personally in my own personal experience, conjuring a sense of place, you know, when you're dealing with a place where you've spent time, a real place. When I'm writing about San Francisco, I could conjure that sense of place pretty easily about like what it's like to walk to Ocean Beach, or what it's like to go into the Mission and see all the people selling like sausages wrapped in bacon on the sidewalk, and, you know, to see all the things that you see every day in the Mission. I know that neighborhood really well, but conjuring a sense of place when it's an imaginary place, when it's an invented place, is really difficult. And she does it just so masterfully, and she writes these beautiful passages that, you know, are layered with folklore and history and customs and, you know, just all of the little details of how people live and how they eat and what they do. But then you drill deeper, and I feel like people sometimes focus on her world building to the exclusion of, or not to the exclusion of, but they underrate her other strengths as a writer. Like her ability to create really complex characters, and like these small quiet moments that just stick with you, and that tell you a lot about the people in her books without kind of bludgeoning you. And something I thought about a while ago that I wrote about in this one essay I wrote about Le Guin is like a couple of her, I read a bunch of her stuff in a row a few years ago. I read all of the Hainish stories, and there's two different scenes in two of her books where someone holds a baby for the first time. In The Dispossessed, it's Shevek holding a baby, and then in Four Ways to Forgiveness, I can't remember who's holding the baby, but she writes about this experience of holding a baby and this like fragile life and how precious it is and how all the feelings that it brings up. And just those moments are so beautifully depicted and so just like crystal and perfect. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that in her writing, like she's really good at these small moments that then, you know, make all of that big world building and all that architecture that she's building, make it resonate so much more. And so I feel like that's the thing that I'm really passionate about, is that people not just focus on what a brilliant world builder she is and how great she is at creating fictional societies, but also just focus on how good she is at creating little moments between people and like all of the little, all of the small, you know, interpersonal quirks and neuroses that create, that make our relationships so fraught and complicated.
Oh, I love everything you just said. And I completely agree. I mean, I'm not overly fond of the phrase world building, because I think it does connote this kind of engineering mindset and approach to writing that people hope they can emulate. But I don't really see that myself in my mother's work. I do see a tremendous ability to evoke place and character and events and emotions. But when I really try to pick apart how she builds those worlds, they're often relatively light on detail and specifics compared to what a lot of writers who are doing world building are doing at the moment. So there's something elusive and magical for me about how she manages to create places that feel so real and so specific with relatively few gestures toward actual specificity, which is not to say that she didn't come up with some wonderful ideas and inventions and devices that allowed her to create those worlds. But she was the first to admit that many of those devices were building on ideas that writers before her had created as well. So it's a, thank you for calling me a writer earlier, Nate. I don't really consider myself one, but I do think that I learned a few things from her. And one was to aspire to that kind of light touch while also creating a sense of place that readers can fall into and stay in for a long time and not feel like they've hit some artificial wall. I also think it's interesting that you chose that quotation from Conversations on Writing about not being able to find your voice as a writer unless you're listening for it, because I had also singled that out as kind of a process point, which is part of what she's talking about in that is, of course, the rhythm of language and the clear, clean line in her writing and in the writing of other authors she admired. But the other part she's talking about is reading your own work to yourself as a form of refining your writing. And that is definitely a small thing that is also huge that I learned from her, which is to read your writing aloud and how profound that is in as an editing tool, as a self-editing tool.
Yeah, to be able to hear your own writing rather than just the visual aspect of it is, yeah. Well, I read your piece in Lit Hub, so that's why I know you're a writer, Theo. So, and we don't have to talk about that too much, but the interesting point of what I liked about that was that, you know, that for those of you who haven't read it, that you recently revised some of the language in her previous work for republications, and it was a very deliberate decision made, but you used your mother's own advice on that, or basically her own, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was a thing that she had on her desk, a note, a quote or something like that. What does it say there? Is it true? Is it necessary or at least useful? Is it compassionate or at least unharmful? And, you know, that's a pretty good way to go through life in pretty much any situation.
To be clear, that is on a note above Ursula's desk. Those are not her exact words, or they're her paraphrase, but I have seen that set of questions now attributed to several major world religions. so it may come from Buddhist tradition. It isn't Ursula's, but she certainly lived by it.
Yeah. And I just liked her, you know, discussion of language, and like when she wrote Left Hand of Darkness, right? That's like the major one in regards to this language conversation, but she didn't have the words or the the they, them pronouns like we have now that are, that language wasn't as prominent then. So I just like the concept of, being okay with, and I think this goes back to listening to your writing and being okay with changing it and knowing that language does evolve as it should, as it needs to, otherwise it will become stagnant. And so I found that fascinating that she was able, she's not some writer who's like, no, I wrote it and that's how it should always be. But she had spoken about, if she could, she would rewrite and use the different pronouns.
Indeed, she did quite a bit of experimentation on the Left Hand of Darkness in revising the use of pronouns without ever rewriting the entire book. So she herself was interested in that. I think that's another thing I learned from her, is to not be afraid of change in language, of neologism, to avoid being rule bound or, grammar policey, because that is the opposite of freedom as an artist. That being said, I didn't especially enjoy changing words in her book, and it's not something that I am seeking to do on a regular basis. I haven't especially enjoyed the reaction that the articles on changes in her and other writers' books have gotten. I think it has exposed an incredibly regressive streak in amongst readers, critics, publishers, people who may be very progressive in terms of, or may see themselves as very progressive in terms of their acceptance of a variety of different kinds of culture, but when it comes to changes to things that they love, are really quite conservative. And those Catwings books are highly beloved of many people, which is one reason there's a new edition of them. So I don't know whether she would have liked the decision I made, or if she had been here, whether she would have made those changes, having been asked to do so by the publisher. And I could drive myself crazy trying to imagine the answer to that question, so I don't. But I also know that the changes were very slight in the scheme of all the text in that series of books, and that, as I said in my LitHub article, I don't think she would have objected had she accepted the premise that some of those words might cause harm to readers. So it wasn't about making readers comfortable or at ease. She believed that kids are tough and will find what they need to in what they read. So I don't see it as an issue of protecting young readers, but by the same token, I do see children's books as different in this discussion than adult books, and that there are considerations around how language does change, how the meaning of word changes. And so part of it is simply making sure that those books are comprehensible to this generation of young readers. Well, yeah, that sounded long and defensive, didn't it?
Well, no, I was right on board with you. Yeah, that that whole time. And even more so after reading the Conversations on Writing, another one, I didn't pull the exact quote, but it's something about, like, if you ask me what story is about, it's about change. In writing a story, it's, the plot, characters have to change and things like that. And change is the one constant we have, right? So, and then I want to pivot a little bit here to, I'm fascinated by Ursula's fascination with science and nature, and it's specifically about how American society often frowns upon imagination for adults, and how, it's that's for kids. And yet also, many people in this country and the world at large can't seem to agree with science either. So it's like, what do you, are you going to pick one or the other, or just you believe in your own imaginations? But that's a whole different conversation. But Growing up, what sort of, how did you engage as a family with nature? You know, because it's very prominent in her own life and writing and appreciation of it and to, you know, be in awe of it and not necessarily understand it, but because some things just can't be understood, but you know, be in awe of it. And I'm curious if there was any, was nature involved in your life growing up? And if so, in what ways and how has that impacted you today?
I wish I could show you where I'm sitting right now because I'm sitting in her writing room and it has windows on two corners that look mostly over green forest park behind me and a sequoia that that my sister planted before I was existing. So wow. it's like being perched in nature. We weren't a camping family. Ursula did not need to go deep into nature or to conquer it in that Hemingway-esque model in order to be part of it. She sat outdoors whenever she could, which in Oregon is not all the time. And she loved to sit in the sun and she loved to be in nature, but with a comfortable chair, I would say.
Love that.
much of her childhood, the summers were spent on a ranch in Napa Valley that her parents bought in 1930. And it's in the hills off the valley floor in a relatively isolated one-way road. And she would go and spend the entire summer there with her mother and her siblings. And the house is still there. It's still in the family. It's little changed since the mid-19th century. It's been managed now into the fourth generation of the family on a principle of benign neglect, I guess, very Taoist. and it's worked quite well. And that house, which I was visiting last week, is the boundary between the house and the acreage around it, the boundary between the outdoor areas that are a little more civilized that we live in and the areas that are now forested and filled with deer and coyotes and ticks, those boundaries are very porous. So I see the incredible influence of those decades of going to that place, which we continued to go to until she was in her 80s. And that idea of the line between the built world and the, you know, human world, so-called, and the rest of nature being a very porous boundary. And I think much of her thinking and writing on the importance of not creating false hierarchical distinctions between humans and other animals and between the built environment and the natural environment comes from those years.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea of a porous boundary, you know, as if we are separate from nature, you know, as if we don't coexist on this earth with the rest of nature. And Charlene, speaking to, you know, to your own writing and I guess the genre of science fiction in general, you know, has science right in the name. And we had an exhibit focused on Ray Bradbury, which you can see online now, but one thing I remember learning about him was he didn't care about the science aspect of it necessarily. Like, he didn't want to get into the details of like how the rocket ships work or whatever. And it made me, you were speaking earlier, Charlie Jane, about world building, quote unquote, but those very human moments of holding a baby for the first time and things like that. And I'm just curious how, you know, in your own writing, does the actual science of it matter to you as much, or is it more about seeing putting humans in these scenarios or non-humans even and those relationships that they have and the relatable moments that
I think where I draw from Le Guin's writing especially is the focus on sort of lived experience and on making things that feel lived in. Like I feel like part of what I love about Le Guin's writing across the board is that there's always an intimacy, even when she's dealing with huge places and huge settings and like giant landscapes. Like she'll sometimes have an individual or two individuals in a lot of cases set against a huge landscape, set against some kind of giant, you know, natural environment or, you know, in space or whatever. And it's always, the focus is always on the intimate and the human and the kind of the human scale and the experience of living through something. And so that's something that I would definitely draw on when I write. That's something that where that's one of the many areas where Le Guin has really influenced me, along with her treatment of gender, which I find really fascinating and inspiring. But, you know, I mean, for me, it really varies. I've been lucky enough to get to talk to a lot of scientists. Like, scientists have been very eager and happy to talk to me about fiction I'm working on, and I've taken advantage of that on a bunch of occasions. I think that when I'm dealing with something that's like a real scientific phenomenon or something that, you know, like when I wrote that novel, The City in the Middle of the Night, which is set on a tidally locked planet, which means that one side of the planet always faces the sun and one side of the planet is always in permanent, you know, eternal darkness, which felt like a really powerful metaphor to me and a really like a beautiful setting to try to explore. That novel is very heavily influenced by Le Guin in terms of just the kind of the try to create that feeling of like a culture that you could live in, a culture that you could actually be immersed in, and a place that has real history and folklore and customs and traditions and internal tensions and like a sense of change happening around you, just because change is always happening around you. But at the same time, I did try really hard to get the science of this other planet right as much as I could and try to, you know, make it as believable as possible. And, you know, I will say that one of the things that inspires me is, again, coming back to The Dispossessed, you know, I've never talked to a physicist about that novel. So I don't know, like, you know, the whole question of this whole issue of simultaneity physics and like the tradition of Odo, or not Odo, but there's a physicist who was our Odo of physics, whose name I don't remember right now. But there's a lot of talk about physics in that book. And there's a lot of talk about what it would take to have instantaneous communication across great distances, the Ansible, which is one of her great inventions. And that's a book where the science, you know, accurate or not, is at the center of the book. And it is what the book is about on some level. And it's about trying to do science. It's about the process of trying to do science under circumstances where, you know, you're struggling with socially imposed restrictions, either from this collectivist society or from capitalism, and you have to kind of pick your poison. But I feel like that's a novel where the handling of science really inspires me because it is so integral to the story, but it's also so personal.
One of the things I think Charlie Jane does tremendously well, and Ursula did also, is to recognize that imagination and rules are not oppositional in fiction, that imagination is freedom, of course, but in order to make that imagination credible to the reader, you are going to have to adopt or create some rules. So if it's pure imagination, if it's fantasy and you have magic, that magic is going to need to have some rules around it. And if you violate the rules that you created, the reader will notice, and that will break the clear, clean line of their reading. If you are using science, then you use the best available actual science you can to inform what you're building. And when that doesn't maybe get you where you need to go imaginatively, that's when you exercise some freedom. But I think that there's a fundamental respect of the reader there, which is that you're doing your homework as a writer to create as credible an imaginative environment as you can, and then to go beyond that where you need to tell the story.
Yeah, I love that. I love the notion that imagination and rules are not mutually exclusive. I think that they almost go together. I mean, whenever you start imagining, you always create parameters, and you always, like when kids are like, the floor is lava or whatever, that's a rule, that's a restriction. It's like, you can't step on the floor because the floor is lava, you know. The family car can fly, but only at night. It can only fly at night. And so if the sun's up, the car can't fly. And like, stuff like that makes the imagination more vivid and more exciting. I think that, you know, it's very hard to imagine it just feels shapeless and formless unless you start like defining some boundaries or some parameters. I feel like that's just what we naturally do with our imagination.
Yeah, that's a great answer. A great analogy too of the floor is lava. I used to play that all the time as a kid, so my mom will be happy to hear that in this episode that is brought up.
It speaks to the connection between world building. There, I just use that phrase that I was poo-pooing earlier, but between world building and play, and you know, the playful element in imagination in creating these environments, and how you can't do that without a sense of playfulness, even if it's serious play. And you know, as Charlie Jane said, whenever we play, whenever we make up games, we start with boundaries and rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One question I like to ask now is, and it's pure conjecture. So if we don't want to guess, we don't have to. But what do you think, Ursula? How do you think she'd be engaging with our current world today? And you know, she passed not too long ago, so it's not like, you know, last month was an episode about Walt Whitman, so that's a little bit different. But you know, I think we know a little bit about how she would be engaging, but. Especially within the events of, you know, these last 3-4 years, like, you know, what do you think her pandemic project would have been, you know, in those early days of quarantine? That's what, you know, if you feel like guessing on that.
Well, she would be writing poetry. I'm certain she was writing poetry right up to the week she passed away. I don't know if that poetry would be directly responsive to the moment we're in. Probably not. But just as well, really, because part of her gift was being able to rise way, way above the moments we're in and to provide us reflection and distance from the obsessions that our culture has, the obsession with fearfulness, the obsession with high technology.
Yeah. And Charlie Jane, you mentioned in the, you know, pre-interview, that capitalism quote, I think that speaks pretty well to how she'd be engaging with this current moment. Is that one that you would like to read, that quote?
Yeah, sure. I would love to read that quote. It's one of my favorite quotes from Le Guin. I think about it a lot lately. Yeah, it's pretty short. So, we live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. But then, so did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, very often in our art, the art of words.
I love that one too.
Yeah, it's so great. It says so much in a very few words.
Yeah, and I just, prior to this conversation, just got to the point in the Conversations on Writing book that goes a little bit like, it's really important what you say in the bad times, goes on. You do your testimony when things are getting bad. And so that's, yeah, you know, her, and words are especially important in this day and age. Yeah. And she, like you said, she never stopped writing, you know, it was always, she had, you know, had to write in a way almost. Yeah.
I think she would also have some notes on the writer strike. notes of solidarity and
exactly, yeah,
notes of disgust for some of the possible outcomes and how that strike is being handled and the lack of solidarity from other groups of artists involved in the Hollywood machine. So I would love to see what she would think about that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Theo, was there any quotes or passages of your mother's that you especially, you know, go back to or that you'd like to read for our listeners?
Well, I chose one which actually I think you could drop in earlier in the interview because this is from the collection The Language of the Night and the essay from 1974, Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons?
Oh, yeah.
He writes about the fear and uses of imagination and how that connects to American culture. So I arrive at my personal defense of the uses of the imagination, especially in fiction and most especially in fairy tale, legend, fantasy, science fiction, and the rest of the lunatic fringe. I believe that maturity is not an outgrowing, but a growing up. that an adult is not a dead child, but a child who survived. I believe that all the best faculties of a mature human being exist in the child, and that if these faculties are encouraged in youth, they will act well and wisely in the adult. But if they are repressed and denied in the child, they will stunt and cripple the adult personality. And finally, I believe that one of the most deeply human and humane of these faculties is the power of the imagination, so that it is our pleasant duty as librarians or teachers or parents or writers, or simply as grownups, to encourage that faculty of imagination in our children, to encourage it to grow freely, to flourish like the green bay tree, by giving it the best, absolutely the best and purest nourishment that it can absorb, and never under any circumstances to squelch it or sneer at it or imply that it is childish or unmanly or untrue.
Woo! Yeah, right. Right.
Take that, literary realism.
That is so beautiful.
I couldn't agree more. That. Yeah. And that reminds me of another one in that book that I'm reading is it's from the operating instructions. And I think the imagination is the single most useful tool mankind possesses. It beats the opposable thumb. I can imagine living without my thumbs, but not without my imagination. I love that. Yeah. I can imagine without thumbs, but I can't imagine without my imagination. Yeah. So as we're wrapping up here, I wanted to give you both a chance. Was there anything that we didn't discuss about Ursula K. Le Guin that you'd like to go over before we wrap it up here?
Yeah, I'm just going to chime in and say kind of what I alluded to earlier, which is that her thought experiments around gender, and not just The Left Hand of Darkness, but a bunch of her other books, remain really salient and remain really important. And I know that they have inspired a whole generation of authors now, from, you know, Anne Leckie to countless trans and queer authors, to play around with gender and to kind of try and imagine how gender and families and social relations involving, you know, concepts of male, female, and other, how those could be different. I think that Le Guin's, a huge part of her impact on the field today does come from her willingness to kind of go counterfactual when it comes to gender.
Mm, yeah. To imagine, you know, we were just talking about imagination, right? To imagine
other absolutely.
Options, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add, Theo?
I could talk about my mother all day. So I was thinking about what Charlie Jane just said. And, you know, not only to inspire and, in a sense, permit subsequent generations of writers to experiment and rethink things around gender, but also just to provide that for readers in their own lives as well. So, I have spoken with many readers who aren't writers who have seen in The Left Hand of Darkness and Ursula's other writing on gender a path forward for their own lives that they might not have found as quickly or in the way they did had it not been for reading that. So again, speaking to the power of writerly imagination to change the world at an individual level.
Yeah, well said.
Nate, I think you should get a little audio of Charlie Jane talking about upcoming projects in the interest of promoting current and next generations of writers.
Please do. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
What you got going on?
Yeah. So like I said, Promise is Stronger Than Darkness, my third young adult book, just came out. And probably by the time you hear this, my New Mutants Lethal Legion miniseries with Marvel will also be finished. Annalie Newitz and I are co-hosting a podcast about science fiction and futurism called Our Opinions Are Correct. And we've been doing a series about how Silicon Valley doesn't understand science fiction, which has been really fun and interesting. And as I mentioned, I'm finishing up a novel called The Prodigal Mother about a young woman who teaches her mother to do magic, which I've seen so many stories about an older person teaching a younger person to do magic. And I've never read a story about a younger person teaching an older person to do magic. So that was something that really interested me. And that's a tough project, but it's one that I'm really finding a lot of joy and fulfillment in. And thank you so much for asking.
What an inspirational list. That's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you for writing. That's what.
Yes. Well said.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you both for being on this episode with me. I had a truly a pleasure talking with you both, Theo and Charlie Jane, and can't wait to read what comes next from you both. And just thank you very much.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.